101 FM,
Free Radio Santa Cruz, also known as Freak Radio, community-based radio station.
Reclaiming the airwaves since 1995, say no to corporate oral smegma.
Freak Radio Santa Cruz is a vital part of this country's independent media.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we're educating the masses.
Tune to Sunday Papers here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM, freakradio.org. Every Sunday at 2 o'clock. Coming up, we got Workers Independent News Week in Review. We have a whole bunch of stories from Al Jazeera English, stuff from Malaysia, from Iraq, Afghanistan, the Philippines. We got stuff about the California economic situation, forest fires in Australia. We got stuff coming out of Gaza, WBAI, Sunday News, Dean Becker's 420 Drug War News, Weekly Radio Spin, Free Press Media Minutes, and right now we're going to hit you with On This Day in History for February 8th. Stay tuned to Sunday Papers.
On this day, February 8th in 1593, mathematician, philosopher, and amateur astronomer Giordano Bruno was arrested and charged with heresy for professing his notions of a heliocentric universe, that is, a universe, or at least a solar system, wherein the planets revolve around the sun rather than around the Pope. He studied for a time with Galileo Galilei, who would later prove some of Bruno's theories. Bruno did his best to appease the inquisitors, but refused to fully recant his views. After 7 years of imprisonment, he was burned at the stake. In 1887, U.S. President Grover Cleveland signed into law the Dawes Act, which effectively rescinded U.S. recognition of tribal sovereignty for most of America's indigenous First Nations by seizing Native American lands held collectively by most individual tribes and allotting that same land to individual Native American families. The notion of an individual land ownership was foreign to most Native Americans, and many today cite the Dawes Act as one of the most destructive influences imposed by the European invaders since the introduction of smallpox. Speaking of destruction, a coal mine in the town of Dawson, New Mexico, exploded on this day in 1923, killing 120 miners. The cause of the explosion was never determined. An even larger explosion took the lives of more than 3,000 coal miners in the Japanese-run Fushun mine in Japanese-occupied Manchuria. And in 1956, an explosion in a coal mine in Belgium killed 8. In 1983, on this day, Israeli Defense Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was removed from office after an Israeli tribunal found him partially culpable for the massacres which took place at the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon the previous year. The Israeli troops under Sharon's direct command had surrounded the camps to prevent anyone from leaving, while Lebanese Christian militias shot, raped, pillaged, and murdered over 800 inhabitants. Some evidence also suggests more direct participation by some Israeli troops. And speaking of disasters, on this day in 1996, U.S. President Clinton, Bill that is, signed into law the Telecommunications Act. The bill eased media cross-ownership restrictions and allowed for the formation of mega-media conglomerates like today's Fox News and Clear Channel. Many media reform activists today cite this as a tremendous setback for diversity in media ownership and broadcast content, as well as for American democracy on the whole. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, February 8th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. Nearly 600,000 U.S. jobs were lost in January, pushing the national official unemployment rate to 7.6%. The U.S. Senate is moving on President Obama's Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act as Republicans continue to try to water down the economic stimulus. Obama acknowledges that this is not perfect legislation, but he says the country has to come together to act quickly with a stimulus that's big enough to have the desired effect of saving and creating jobs and stimulating the economy. The president, in office less than 3 weeks, has already signed into law a bill making it easier for women suffering pay discrimination to legally challenge that discrimination. He's also signed executive orders helping to level the playing field for unions and federal contracts. President Obama, in stark contrast from the former occupant of the White House, says that he is pro-union.
We know that you cannot have a strong middle class without a strong labor movement. We have to reverse many of the policies towards organized labor that we've seen these last 8 years. I do not view the labor movement as part of the problem. To me, it's part of the solution.
The U.S. Senate on Thursday postponed a committee vote on the Labor Secretary nomination of Representative Hilda Solis after her husband paid $6,400 to settle outstanding tax liens Republicans had delayed action on Solis's nomination earlier out of their opposition to the Employee Free Choice Act labor law reform. The Obama administration says the Solis nomination is not in trouble. Solis is the most pro-worker, pro-union labor secretary nominee in many, many years. As the Economic Recovery Act moves toward passage in the Senate, the Obama administration is looking at new ways to make the spending in this massive bill transparent. Jesse Russell reports.
Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood unrolled a new plan on Thursday to make spending under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan accountable and transparent. Part of the plan is to have an oversight board post updates on a new government website called recovery.gov.
See where the dollars are spent, in which cities and towns the money is going to, and for which projects.
U.S. automakers are using another round of buyout incentives to get rid of well-paid current UAW members so that new workers can be hired at half their salary. GM is offering $20,000 in cash and a $25,000 new vehicle voucher to employees who are willing to quit. GM will also likely offer early retirement to workers over 50 with 10 years of service. Chrysler is also considering options to buy out employees. The buyout offers are going to 91,000 UAW members. Amy Peterson is president of New, Non-Traditional Employment for Women. It's a New York City program that helps women get into the union construction trades.
They get a good entry-level wage that then goes up dramatically as they learn their trade. They have a real skill, and they transform their lives. They are able to provide for their families. They do things that they couldn't imagine that they could do when they walk through the door of our program.
For more labor news, visit laborradio.org. Workers Independent News, we can review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The cold February wind sweeps south through the Hindu Kush ranges, but this has been a mild season by Afghan standards. In Kabul, the markets do a roaring trade. In the mountains, the fighting is fierce. This winter has seen no break in the violence. If anything, it's intensified. But there's also been a brutal political offensive, and it could spell trouble for the Afghan president.
President Karzai himself, personally, had thought that he's immune to criticism by the friends of Afghanistan.
Former Foreign Minister and Mujahideen fighter Abdullah Abdullah denies he's one of a small group of leading figures allegedly being courted by the Obama administration to run for the presidency in elections delayed until August. It's clear to many people here, though, the US has started to shift its political focus, highlighting government corruption. That has angered supporters of President Karzai.
If they support someone else, they should come forward. They should have a step and they should say that they are supporting someone else. If they are not doing that, it means that they are supporting Mr. Karzai.
The growing number of civilian casualties is adding to the problem. President Karzai has become increasingly vocal, perhaps under domestic political pressure, but it hasn't made relations with Washington any easier.
Barack Obama promised to bring hope and change to America. Here on the streets of Afghanistan, there is an expectation things will change, but that's little cause for hope. Because no matter how much US policy shifts, how many extra troops it sends, and who it backs politically, no one here seriously believes the fighting will stop anytime soon.
The Taliban remains politically influential here, so its view is also worth considering.
The problem is with the foreigner here, with the American. If instead of Karzai, other one is coming, he will be like Karzai. He will not do anything for Afghanistan because he has no power in Afghanistan. The power is with the other people. They are the real government in Afghanistan.
When Hamid Karzai addresses the Munich Security Conference on Sunday, it will be an important moment for his presidency. He's under pressure to prove his credentials and consolidate international support. His leadership may depend on it. Hamish McDonald, Al Jazeera, Kabul.
Up next, we have a story here about an Iraqi woman who is being held for apparently accused of recruiting suicide bombers.
Codename Mother of the Believers, the alleged recruiter of dozens of women suicide bombers. In this Iraqi security force video, Samira Ahmed Jassim tells of her work for an Al-Qaeda-linked group.
I met Amal and we stayed together for more than 2 weeks. I talked to her until I convinced her that she was in a bad situation. She'd been treated badly by her husbands and brothers. She was mentally exhausted. I then took her to see my contacts. Then I received her back from them at the same delivery place. This is where she then blew herself up.
Jassim is accused of targeting vulnerable women, widows, or often victims of rape or domestic violence, convincing them that suicide bombings are the only way to regain their honor and that of their families.
She confessed to training more than 28 female suicide bombers, all of whom conducted terrorist operations in different parts of Iraq.
The U.S. military says there were 32 female suicide bomb attacks in Iraq last year, up from 8 in 2007. One of the most deadly occurred in Baghdad last month. Dozens were killed and at least 70 injured when a bomber targeted Shia pilgrims. The attacks reflect a change in tactics. Male security forces are forbidden culturally to search women, so those wanting to carry out the attacks are exploiting women's traditional flowing robes to conceal explosives. The Iraqi government has responded to the threat by training more women police officers, more than 500 graduating from this Baghdad academy just last week. They'll be hoping the capture of one active recruiter and the work of these women will prevent further deadly attacks. Tarek Basley, Al Jazeera.
All right, Free Radio, 101 FM, freakradio.org. This one's about Malaysia from Al Jazeera as well. Al Jazeera English. Go to aljazeera.net/English and you can actually watch all these things, all these shows. You can even download a media player, a live station media player, and watch Al Jazeera live 24 hours a day if you want to on your computer. This one actually started a little late. I didn't get the, it was live and I couldn't get it and at the beginning, so we're going to start with it just at the very start of it, a little bit we missed, so stay tuned for that. And then we got another one about Filipino downturn, economics downturn, and then California's economic downturn. Then we'll break with a tune, so stay tuned. Sunday Papers, Free Radio.
Ambush followed by a new state government, whether the people in Perak wanted it or not. In March, they voted in the opposition amid unprecedented gains across the country. But four defections in recent days have tipped the state's balance of power back in favour of the ruling National Front coalition.
The masses felt that their rights have been snatched by UMNO.
Up until a few days ago, Mohamed Nizar Jamaluddin led Perak's opposition Pakatan Rakyat government. But he's not going down without a fight.
Our next plan is just to get a move within the court to declare that I am still the legitimate chief minister.
Some opposition politicians have accused the National Front of trying to bribe its way back into power. One politician said he was offered 5 million ringgit by the ruling coalition after elections. That's 1.3 million US dollars.
Then again on the eve of swearing in, I got a call again. This time it went to 10 million. They say, we will come to KLIA immediately. We'll give you the 10 million assurance of the 10 million, and then you can fly to any destination. On your return, you just announce you're quitting the party. We have given the information, the SMS, all to the ACA, the anti-corruption agency, but there's no action.
Zamri Abdul Kadir is the new chief minister of Perak. He denies the allegations.
Even on our side also, they're trying to lure our reps. They also say a lot of things about it.
So you're categorically denying all of
the accusations? Yeah, there is that. We are not indulged in that, into that kind of politics.
Despite controlling 60% of the seats in the national parliament, the ruling coalition is struggling to remain relevant to many Malaysians. Ethnic Chinese and Indians especially feel sidelined by the political process, and events in Perak are unlikely to reassure them. And then there's the part of the royal family. The Sultan of Perak endorsed the National Front's takeover instead of calling for new elections. This has, in many eyes, damaged his reputation for political neutrality. Members of the opposition will next week launch an unprecedented lawsuit against the revered ruler's decision. Many Malaysians tasted a change in politics for the first time in 50 years last year. Now they're unwilling to give that up. Laura Kyle, Al Jazeera, Perak, Malaysia.
They still come here every day looking for work abroad. Undeterred by news that thousands of Filipinos already working overseas are now losing their jobs. Like 26-year-old Jobert, who has to take care of 8 brothers and sisters.
I have to take that chance. Life here is hard, and there are a lot of people depending on me. If I find a job, then I can send them
money. There are already around 9 million overseas Filipino workers, or OFWs as they're called here. That's 10% of the population, and a million more are leaving every year. The billions of dollars they send home help keep the Philippine economy afloat. But as the global economy shrinks and workers lose their jobs, the Philippine government is worried about one of its most important sources of revenue.
We will have to ensure that their rights are protected, that they get whatever pay is due to them and the benefits as well. And after we have done that, we try to find immediate employment opportunities where we can rechannel them.
On recent trips abroad, President Gloria Arroyo has been courting new employers, looking to expand the market for OFWs. At the same time, she's released emergency funds to help those who have had to return home.
This OFW reintegration center is less than 2 years old. Now, hundreds come through the door here every day to seek assistance. It can be anything from signing up to classes to upgrade their skills, to getting a free telephone card, or simply watching a specially produced show about other OFW stories.
The students in this class recently lost their jobs in Taiwan. They're learning new skills and will receive grants to help start their own small businesses.
It's helping me motivate myself to stay here because my mind is so set already into going outside again.
Chasing dreams overseas has become part of Filipino culture. Millions here still think it's better to get away than stay. More than just economics, some say it's an entire mindset that has to change. Unless people feel they can have their dreams come true at home, the Philippines will remain dependent on shifting international tides. Margo Ortigas, Al Jazeera, Manila.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, Sunday Papers. My name is Skidmark Bob. We're sitting here playing news for you for the next hour until 2 o'clock. Coming up, we got something here about California from AlJazeeraEnglish.net. Excellent news program. If you want to check it out, AlJazeeraEnglish, AlJazeera.net/English, or you can go to YouTube and search for Al Jazeera English, and they have a YouTube page where they have all the videos you could watch and download there for free of a lot of these programs that I'm playing for you the audio of. Here's one about California economic downturn.
The lights of San Francisco's skyline still dazzle, but in the cold light of day, just an hour down the road, you can glimpse the signs of California's distress. In Silicon Valley, home to some of the most successful high technology companies in the world, whole buildings are shutting down, some even bulldozed to reduce the glut of unneeded office space. The Golden State is suffering its worst job losses in at least 30 years. 300,000 jobs vanished in 2008, and even more are expected this year. And no sector of the economy here is immune. Some kinds of employment are gone for good. Intel, a pioneering microprocessor maker, shutting down the last chip plant in the area and sacking all its manufacturing staff here. At the local unemployment benefits office, the applicants talk of the bottom falling out of the job market. These people have been out of work for months.
I've been calling my agency like 3 times a week, but nobody responds.
Right now I'm trying to get anything like, you know, basic assembly or customer service. But if it doesn't work, I plan to go back to school and talk to a counselor and see, you know, try various options.
I'd like to get retrained and try to pick up some other skills that might help me to broaden my skill level to get a job.
And as payrolls shrink, so do tax collections, deepening the state's already record $42 billion deficit. The result?
Each of us has to give up something because our country is in an economic crisis and our state simply doesn't have the money.
The state is freezing construction work, cutting paid work hours for its employees, and postponing college student grants and welfare checks. In Los Angeles, teachers protested budget cuts that will mean fewer jobs, bigger classes. And the state's plans to extend health insurance to every Californian may be shelved indefinitely.
If you're facing
laying off teachers and denying medical care to people, it's probably not a time that you're going to be able to start a new multi-billion dollar initiative.
If President Barack Obama's stimulus package passes Congress, California can expect its share of dollars, but no one is predicting when the Golden State's glow of prosperity will be back. Tom Ackerman, Al Jazeera, San Jose, California.
Yes, I think we could agree that theme song is going to come in real handy for us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Kinks with Low Budget. Coming up now, we have the weekly radio spin. Stay tuned, Free Radio.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin. A look at the stories behind the news. Brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. In our top spin, Shell just can't seem to get it right. Last year, the oil company was faulted twice for misleading ads. Britain's Advertising Standards Authority criticized Shell for ads that showed carbon dioxide emissions being used to grow flowers, and ads that called tar sands development sustainable. Shell is heavily invested in Canada's tar sands, which are the dirtiest source of oil. So, are Shell's new ads more honest? Not really. One refers to the tar sands by claiming, quote, "We need to get at some of the difficult oil trapped in sand, rock, and in the deepest seas," end quote. Environmental groups criticize the new ads, but Shell's marketing firm, JWT, defends them. It says the problem is that the British advertising watchdog doesn't understand the energy business.
American jobs, national security, and billions of dollars at stake. That's what the website PreserveRaptorJobs.com warns. The website promotes continuing U.S. military contracts for F-22 Raptor fighter jets as a way to support jobs and stimulate the economy. But U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has said the military has enough F-22s and the jets aren't helpful in the so-called war on terror. So who's behind PreserveRaptorJobs.com? The website doesn't say, but it's hosted by a public relations firm called Democracy Data and Communications, or DDC. DDC specializes in online astroturf, or fake grassroots campaigns, for corporate clients. It's set up sites for Microsoft, Ford Motor Company, and the mortgage giant Fannie Mae. DDC also has close ties to government agencies. In 2006, it co-sponsored a conference on using technology to expand and strengthen democracy, along with the U.S.-funded International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute.
Michelle Obama isn't only an intelligent and elegant first lady, she's great for marketing. At least that's what Procter & Gamble thinks. In 2007, Procter & Gamble launched a multicultural marketing campaign called My Black is Beautiful. Actor Angela Bassett took part in the My Black is Beautiful promotional tour.
Procter & Gamble, they're committed to black women who are big consumers. We are about being fierce and beautiful, and we take care of ourselves, and they're committed by virtue of what we see here today.
Procter & Gamble claims My Black is Beautiful is more than advertising, it's a movement. But the campaign was launched in response to marketing data showing that black women spend 3 times more on beauty products than the general female population. Procter & Gamble is now working with BET on a My Black is Beautiful television series. The first episode will honor Michelle Obama in response to other marketing data that 90% of black women think that the First Lady will help improve perceptions of black beauty.
The Defense Department is spending more and more money to promote itself within the United States. Some of its PR efforts, like America Supports You and the Pentagon Pundit Program, have been criticized as improper or illegal, as the Weekly Radio Spin reported previously. Over the past 5 years, Pentagon spending on domestic PR has increased more than 60% to almost $5 billion in 2009. That's nearly as much as the Pentagon spent on body armor for troops in Iraq and Afghanistan between 2004 and 2006. The Pentagon now employs 27,000 people for PR, advertising, and recruitment efforts in the United States. The entire State Department employs 30,000 people.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned Procter & Gamble. The company has frequently pushed marketing boundaries. In 2001, it formed a word-of-mouth marketing program called Tremor, which encouraged teens to promote products to their friends. It also has a website called Being Girl, which offers girls advice on dating, makeup, and their menstrual cycles. The website says it's, quote, the place to be for the hottest free samples from Always and Tampax, end quote.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Queen of Caffeine, and we're educating the masses.
A rescue center for the victims of the world's sex trade. At the end of the corridor in the Moldovan capital, Chisinau, is the telephone.
Hello.
That for thousands of women around the world is their only line to hope. Stella's voice is probably the first voice the caller has heard that offers genuine help of a release from sex traffickers.
My mission and the work I do helps in rescuing and identifying and repatriating Moldovan victims who fall prey to traffickers abroad and who are exploited in many destination countries.
The bright lights of the city are often irresistible for the young women. They come from the villages looking for a way out of their poverty. Many of the victims are lured abroad by friends, official-looking travel agencies, sometimes even a job ad in the paper. But when they get there, there are no waitressing or babysitting jobs. Instead, their papers and passports are taken away and they become sex slaves for their pimps. Vera, which isn't her real name, was brought here to this secret rehabilitation centre. She's one of hundreds of victims who have been helped here. Most of them need urgent medical and psychological treatment.
I went with a girlfriend to look for work, but I was taken to a hotel in Istanbul and put in a room with other girls. It was then that I realized that I'd been sold. I wanted to run away, but it was too late. I was forced to work for 2 weeks before I managed to escape.
As well as being the only European country on the US government's human trafficking blacklist, Moldova is also considered one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The US has accused some in the Moldovan government of being complicit in the trade.
There have been accusations that there are public officials involved in the trafficking of human beings. We currently have 6 criminal cases launched against public servants, and they're undergoing criminal investigation.
The crushing poverty in the villages is a compelling reason for women to look for a way out. 5 people live here, in this tiny converted stable. There's no running water and little food. The parents leave these children alone all day. In the village, many young women are lured abroad. 17-year-old Samira wants to leave, but she's frightened because so many friends have gone before and never come back.
Some of them went to Italy, some to Turkey, but they were tricked. They were told they would be given work abroad, but in fact they were sold.
More than 400,000 Moldovans work abroad, sending home an estimated $1 billion a year. Their remittances keep the country afloat.
It's very hard for the victims of trafficking to rebuild their lives if they're lucky enough to get home. When they get back, their families disown them. Few ever marry. Their lives ruined forever. But the agencies here predict the pipeline of victims is unlikely to dry up anytime in the near future. Stephen Cole, Hinchest, Moldova.
Hello, listeners. I hope you're enjoying the program on your radio station. My name is Martin from scan.org. An independent political and cultural radio program produced in Eastern Australia in a magazine style. You can find it at radioforall.net if you wish. I'd just like to say hello to you all and remind you that we're both tasting the salty wind of the same ocean. Long live Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM. Support your community radio. Check out freakradio.org.
On the ground and from the air, firefighters battle desperately to bring raging bushfires under control. More than 40 blazes are now burning across 3 states in southeastern Australia, and the extremely hot and dry conditions mean there's unlikely to be any respite soon. More than 100,000 firefighters are on standby in the states of Victoria, South Australia and New South Wales, and they're backed up by the residents themselves. Many people stay behind and defend their homes, or at least try to. Up to 100 have already been destroyed. Lives too have been lost. Authorities believe dozens of people may have died as a result of the fires or from the extreme heat. For most Australians, fires are a summertime certainty, but this year has been the worst in more than 2 decades. Parts of the country are in the midst of a once-in-a-century heatwave, with the mercury topping 46 degrees. Melbourne has recorded its hottest day in more than 150 years. And with the power supply of Australia's second largest city under threat, many sought respite indoors.
The air conditioning stopped and then we started getting hot air coming through our vents, so it's not at all pleasant.
It's really hot at home, so we thought it would be colder here, but no, it's not colder at all.
In Sydney, residents had another option. Crowds flocked to beaches and pools as the city faced a record number of consecutive days over 40 degrees.
Oh, very hot, mate, very, very hot. That's why we're here today. It's a bit of relief.
For some, it was all too much. But this is a country of extremes. North of the heatwave and the fires lies the state of Queensland, and parts of it are underwater. Residents in the far north are preparing for more flash floods and high tides, and no doubt hoping for a break in the weather. Jaina Zapati, Al Jazeera.
Tune to Free Radio 101 FM, freakradio.org, Sunday Papers. And up next, we got a couple stories coming out of Gaza. We're going to start off with about Gaza fishermen and what they go through on a daily basis trying to get fish and food for their families. We're going to hear about the sports that help young Gazans cope with what's going on right now. And then we'll also hear about the Hamas accused of killing people that oppose them. Opponents, we'll hear that. That one's the latest one. So we'll hear 3 of those from Al Jazeera, and then we'll get into some other news coming right up here. Sunday Papers. Don't forget to tune in to Third Paradigm coming up at 2 o'clock, Free Radio.
It's a tradition here that stretches back for centuries. Small wooden fishing boats make their way out to sea in the morning light, searching for the day's catch. But not everything here is the same. Now, within striking range, are Israeli gunboats patrolling these waters, enforcing a strict naval blockade that fishermen say threatens their livelihood.
10 minutes before you came, they were shooting at us. The bullets hit the surface of the water around us. They're trying to distance us from our fishing.
Like many of Gaza's fishermen, Mohammed Abu Hasira says fishing has been in his family's blood for generations. Nowadays, it's become a dangerous game of cat and mouse. Israeli gunboats chase down fishing boats they deem to have come too far out to sea. Many fishermen here claim that the Israeli Navy tries to intimidate them by firing at their boats.
When I work now, I have to keep looking left and right, frightened that they might come towards us and shoot at us. As soon as I pull the net in, I always pull the boat back right away.
Fishermen here say under the Oslo Peace Accords, they're permitted to fish more than 30 kilometers offshore, but that the Israelis have changed the rules, allowing them to fish only 5 kilometers off the coast, sometimes less, severely limiting their hauls in such shallow water. Israel claims these boats are smuggling weapons.
I heard the first two shots, and when I heard the third one, I felt my leg was exploding and blood was everywhere.
This is a bullet that struck Ala Fuad Al-Halbil. He tells us an ordinary day of fishing turned bad when he was shot in the leg, he says, by the Israelis. Doctors think it will be about a month until he can walk again. The Ministry of Agriculture estimates that 12 fishing vessels have been destroyed and 70 damaged since the war began. For the estimated 4,000 fishermen here, it has added a new dimension to an old tradition.
This is our only income. We don't know how to do anything else. Do they want us to leave the sea? We will never do that.
As Gazans try to restore normality to their daily lives following the war, Gaza's fishermen press on, hoping to net more fish than catching bullets. Mike Hirsch, Al Jazeera, Gaza Harbor.
Gaza is a land scarred by war, immense pain and despair. But glimmers of hope are still part of the landscape. Since the end of the war, Taha Bakr has come to Gaza Beach to surf whenever he can. Before he gets near the water, he is reminded of the violence that happened here. For Bakr and two of his friends, surfing is their way to escape the harsh reality that is Gaza.
For sure, surfing allows me to forget about what happened. When I am on a wave, I'm away from all the troubles of the real world.
The open water of the Mediterranean Sea, albeit rough on this day, is an oasis of serenity. So traumatized are the people of Gaza after 22 days of Israeli airstrikes, many of them are turning to sports to help ease their anxiety.
When I surf, I feel free like a bird. No one controlling me, no one telling me what to do. I can forget about what happened and how bad the situation is.
Catching a wave, skateboarding, even rollerblading, young Gazans who may not fully understand why or how all of this could happen are doing this to move forward or perhaps create a distraction.
This was once a thriving complex for football, basketball, and various other sports, but as you can see, most of the facilities were completely destroyed. Still, the young people of Gaza are not giving up.
Through chunks of metal and debris, we found 19-year-old Wasim Al-Danaf rollerblading in what is left of the sports complex. He didn't lose any loved ones in the war, but his life is forever changed by the violence.
Skating allows us to forget what happened. It gets us away from the rubble and the misery that we have to live with.
Bakr used to surf with a third friend, Nizar Abu Arab, but he says Israeli forces killed him months before this latest conflict. He understands the misery of war.
Every morning my father tells me that things will get better. But each day seems harder than the last.
As he ends another session on Gaza Beach, Taha Bakr can't help but think of Palestinian-Israeli relations and wonder if the tide will ever change. Todd Bear, Al Jazeera, Gaza City.
Yeah.
Naeem Atallah recalls the painful beating his son Osama, a schoolteacher and Fatah supporter, received after Hamas won elections here 3 years ago. It's what followed just days ago, finding his son's lifeless body at the morgue at Shifa Hospital, strangled with blunt force trauma to the head and a bullet in the shoulder, that has rocked his faith in Hamas and Fatah reconciling amidst an increasingly bloody rivalry for power. He says his son, the father of five children, the youngest a daughter, born just 2 days before he was killed, was taken from his family's home by 10 masked men he claims were from the internal security branch of Hamas, armed with Kalashnikovs.
I asked them, "Who are you?" They answered, "We're from the internal security." I asked them, "How do I know that?" One of them showed me his ID card.
This Fatah supporter, large screws holding one of his legs together after being shot 3 times, says 15 Hamas agents came calling 2 weeks ago. He asked us to conceal his identity, fearing they might come back.
There were 15 guys with hoods over their heads. 3 of them asked me to stand against the wall and ask me my name. Then they started shooting. They shot me because I am Fatah.
Internationally recognized human rights groups in Gaza have shown Al Jazeera sworn affidavits, medical records, and photos of victims they say substantiate alleged reprisals committed against Fatah supporters by security agents or associates of Hamas.
Tens of Fatah members were shot and tortured.
Human rights monitor Halil Abu Shamala says what he calls revenge killings began taking place amidst the chaos of Israel's 3-week offensive here. He says many victims were jailed Fatah supporters and other inmates Hamas had labeled collaborators with Israel who fled Gaza City's central prison after it was bombed.
The moment I was here, I heard 2 bullets.
Gaza resident and New York Times reporter Takrid El-Khodri herself was at the scene of one such revenge killing here at Shifa Hospital. Seconds after it happened, she said an unidentified man looked down at her from a balcony celebrating what he called the death of a collaborator.
And I'm looking at him and he saw how I was horrified. And he told me, "Are you horrified for a collaborator?"
Human rights groups say authorities here have done very little so far to investigate these crimes and bring anyone to justice. However, one Hamas official we spoke with said a number of investigations are underway.
All our investigations are open to everyone.
Ihab Al-Ghussein is a spokesperson for the Ministry of Interior.
With all due respect to you, you're a spokesperson. Are you telling me that you can show us documents, case files of people that you're investigating right now if we asked you to show them to us?
Well, sure, yes. Anytime if you want, I can make an arrangement with the security agencies and the people who are, related to these cases, and you can see everything about that.
Today?
We have no problem. No, it's not. I'm not talking about today. You know, it's we still continue in our arrangements. We have no buildings. We don't have places. But if you want it, we can arrange it anytime.
Several follow-up attempts to see proof of their investigations went unanswered. All he would say is that the attack stopped after the 3-week war.
After this war, we don't let anyone to take the law by himself. Nobody is allowed to kill anyone, beat anyone, arrest anyone.
But human rights observers say attacks against Fatah supporters have in fact happened since the war ended and still continue, citing the death of Osama Atallah and the shooting of this man as recent examples.
Look, I don't ignore that there are some mistakes done by members of Hamas, but I think it is not a policy adopted by the leadership here. Yeah, when we say that there are some mistakes done by someone, we try to stop it and to correct the mistakes.
Many here fear the revenge killings are widening more than just the political divide between Hamas and Fatah.
We don't have just the political divide in the Palestinian political system, but also we start to get social divide in the society itself. So
that's dangerous.
This is the most dangerous thing. Yeah.
When will this madness end?
This madness will stop when we have unity between Hamas and Fatah and both sides reconcile. That way we'll become one and be able to stand against our enemy, Israel.
And when Palestinians stop killing Palestinians, says the father of slain Fatah supporter Osama Atallah.
Isn't that forbidden?
Mike Kirsch, Al Jazeera, Gaza.
This is Attila the Stockbroker. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org, 101.1 FM, reclaiming the airwaves since 1995. Say no to corporate oral smegma.
Jessica Ramos from Trade Unionist in Solidarity with Colombia summarized the struggle at the Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia.
We can no longer sit still. We can no longer keep quiet as we learn of the atrocities these men and women in Colombia are experiencing. Threats, kidnappings, tortures, and murders have taken place in response to unionization. We believe earning a living wage in order to provide ourselves and our families with food, shelter, and clothing is a human right, and we will stop at nothing to defend it.
Luis Adolfo Cardona witnessed the assassination of union contract negotiator Isidro Segundo Gil at the Carepa bottling plant in 1996, and he had to flee the country after paramilitaries attempted to kidnap him.
I quickly raced towards him, 100 meters away from the firing. I noticed the paramilitaries had jumped back onto the motorcycle and were fleeing the scene. When I reached his body, I tried to see if he was still alive, if I could help. I put my hands under his head. At that point, I realized that his head had come apart in my hands. My hands were covered in his blood. I noticed administrators and co-workers around me, around Isidro's body, asking me what happened. I said it was the paramilitaries. And a few minutes later, Isidro's family was now surrounding me as well. I noticed that his two young daughters rushed towards him, and now in his pool of blood, were telling him, "Daddy, Daddy, wake up, don't leave us."
Under pressure from the NYU Republican students and others who claim that this is not a human rights but a consumer choice issue, the NYU Senate voted on Thursday to lift the ban on the sale of Coca-Cola products on campus. Student advocacy groups are now vowing to continue the fight in court and publicly denounce Coca-Cola's unethical and, they say, criminal actions. For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Our guest on last week's Cultural Baggage was Tulia defense attorney, one-time Texas Attorney of the Year, Jeff Blackburn. And as promised, here's part of the discussion you didn't get to hear on that program.
You were, if not the first, most likely the first person to ever get a medical marijuana...
Not guilty verdict. In Texas,
of all places.
The facts were real simple. I had a 53-year-old client who was cursed with disease, a particular form of HIV called non-progressing HIV. And believe me, if you have non-progressing HIV, you probably would wish it would progress into AIDS, because basically what it means is you're really sick a lot all the time, and then you don't die. Horrible, horrible condition. He suffered from a particular symptom of this disease that caused him to vomit uncontrollably. And it had been so bad that he'd been hospitalized twice before. It becomes life-threatening when you do that, because it'll really and truly tear up your stomach and your esophagus so badly that you won't be able to swallow anymore. And it can begin bleeding and ultimately lead to death. Marijuana is a substance that has been proven historically over and over again to be a very effective solution to this kind of problem. You know, and there are plenty of studies and empirical research that back that up. He went out and scored 3 grams, that's right, 3 grams of weed. He was out smoking with the guys he bought it from. A nosy neighbor reported them to the police, undoubtedly to get money from Crime Stoppers, probably. The police showed up and arrested him. And we were able to prove through both his testimony and the brilliant, brilliant work of a guy named Steve Jennison, who is a totally dedicated doctor, who's the head of the medical marijuana program in the state of New Mexico. We were able to prove how beneficial marijuana was, what it meant, how it applied to his situation, and it got very interesting. Because we had a jury on that case. This case was tried in Amarillo, Texas, my hometown. It is not known as being a stronghold of left-wing progressive politics. Yet, that jury, once they began to see not only what the facts of the case were, but they also began to understand that what's involved with marijuana regulation and prohibition is essentially an arrogant decision by the government to impose upon people who are sick a false policy. That just pissed them off. And the result was they found this guy not guilty in 12 minutes.
Be sure to check out Jeff Blackburn's work with the Texas Innocence Project. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Despite a decades-long drug war, billions of dollars spent, and millions of Americans locked up, drug use rates have remained relatively constant. When a drug dealer is busted, it's nothing more than a job opening for someone to fill. It's Economics 101. Join Students for Sensible Drug Policy to help teach lawmakers this simple economics lesson. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out if there's a chapter at your school or how to start one.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In October 2007, a group of 16 scholars from 11 American universities joined together to draft a communications policy agenda for the next administration. Last week, the Future of American Communications Working Group released its recommendations in a book called And Communications for All. Amit Schechter, an assistant professor of telecommunications at Penn State University, edited the book. Schechter believes that academics have an important role to play in telecommunications policymaking.
We are all funded by public money, and we owe allegiance only to the public. The work of academia, when it can, should be within the public domain, and since all of us, in one way or another, are policy researchers, we want to contribute to the policy debate our position as academics, which are arguments that can be substantiated, that are based on many years of study and research, and that do not represent a partisan or stakeholder's position.
The book covers issues like media ownership, broadband access, the wireline and wireless industries, cable, content issues, media representations of women and people of color, the role of public media, and protecting teenage privacy. Schechter says that no one idea in the book is radical, but the sum of its parts are unique.
The radical thing about it is that there is such agreement among the authors of this book about the principles of the new policy. And I think that that's radical in an academic world.
The authors of And Communications for All agree that the government needs to take an active role to ensure that Americans have access to telecommunications technologies. They also agree that uniform rules covering cable, telephone, and wireless will be much more efficient in providing better services to more people. And they all share the belief that the market is not always the answer to problems concerning crucial public infrastructure.
Telecommunication infrastructure doesn't only exist in order to serve markets. We believe that we need to create more competitive and fairer markets on the one hand, but we need to focus government policy on the creation of needed public goods and spaces where hyper-commercialism is not at the center, but actually at the sidelines.
Hate crimes against Latinos have risen nearly 40% since 2003. The National Hispanic Media Coalition wants to know whether a spike in anti-Latino hate speech on TV and radio, coming not just from the fringes but well-known talkers like Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, is contributing to the violence. Last week, the group called upon the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
This is a national epidemic. The growth is spurred each day by hate speech, distortion of facts, and anti-immigrant sentiment expressed on cable shows, local radio shows, and across the airwaves.
That's John Amaya of the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund speaking about the effort last week in Washington.
The serious topic of immigration has been contaminated by hatred and racism, and it's created a toxic climate which fosters and condones violence and civil rights violations, all motivated by bigotry.
In addition to petitioning the FCC, the group is also asking the National Telecommunications and Information Administration to update a study last done in 1993 on the role of telecommunications in hate crimes. Last week, the coalition released a preliminary report by the UCLA Chicano Studies Research Center on hate speech in commercial talk radio. Former FCC Commissioner Gloria Tristani lauded the effort.
The rise in hate speech in the media and hate speech targeting Latinos, coupled with the rise in hate crimes targeting Latinos, cries out for a thorough, factual investigation into the extent and nature of hate speech and the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
Jessica Gonzalez from the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown University Law Center, which is partnering with the National Hispanic Media Coalition, explains the groups are seeking a study, not any regulations on speech.
It will seek an examination into the extent
and nature of hate speech in our media, and options for counteracting or reducing the negative impacts of such speech.
Inez Gonzalez of the National Hispanic Media Coalition emphasizes that the petition does not call for a revival of the fairness doctrine. The National Hispanic Media Coalition insists the answer is not suppressing speech, but more speech. For more information, visit the National Hispanic Media Coalition's website at nhmc.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.